Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us, written by Rochelle Bergstein. Not everyone was such a big fan of the stiletto. Just like Dior's voluptuous bell-shaped skirts, tall, thin heels drew criticism even at the height of their popularity. The New York Times ran an article on May 28, 1955, warning that posture is affected by the size of the heels. A Dr. Gerald Warner of Buffalo, New York, recommended that, for the sake of their carriage, tall women should wear high heels, while short women should stick to low ones. Questionable health advice that also managed to rob petite fashion fans of the chance for a little upward mobility. In a primer called The Essential Eve, A Guide to Women's Perfection, one medical professional advised, excessively high heels will always be a source of danger to feet and eventually to health. Their habitual use causes the calf muscles to contract to such an extent that it becomes almost impossible to walk. Warner eschewed a bit of practical wisdom, still de rigueur to this day, that heel enthusiasts should sometimes give their feet a break, opting for sneakers or flats in order to be kind to one's arches. Above all, he said, women should wear the same size heels consistently. Still, many women varied their heels as a practice. Saddle shoes and ballet flats were both popular styles, worn by the housewife during the day to be swapped out for more flattering feminine shoes when she heard her husband's car in the driveway. Flat shoes were also particularly trendy among teenage girls, still on the cusp of sexual maturity, and thus less restrained by the sartorial standards meant to visually define womanhood. The Bobby Soxer, named for the way she rolled her socks down over her low-heeled Mary Janes or her two-tone saddle shoes, was often a dull-faced junior high school-aged girl in a poodle skirt. She was allowed to pine for, say, blue-eyed crooner Frank Sinatra, precisely because her feelings were regarded as immature and therefore innocent, a freedom not afforded to a girl past a certain age who could appreciate the implications of her sexual identity. In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, written by Alice Walker. I am discouraged when a faculty member at Sarah Lawrence says, there is not enough literature by Black women and men to make a full year's course, or that the quantity of genuine Black literature is too meager to warrant a full year's investigation. This is incredible. I am disturbed when Eldridge Cleaver is considered the successor to Ralph Ellison on campuses like this one. This is like saying Kate Millett's book Sexual Politics makes her the new Jane Austen. It is shocking to hear that the only Black woman writer white and Black academicians have heard of is Gwendolyn Brooks. Fortunately, what Sarah Lawrence teaches is a lesson called How to Be Shocked and Dismayed, but Not Lie Down and Die. And those of you who have learned this lesson will never regret it, because there will be ample time and opportunity to use it. Your job when you leave here, as it was the job of educated women before you, is to change the world. Nothing less or easier than that. We must believe that it is, for the world is not good enough. We must make it better. But it is a great time to be a woman, a wonderful time to be a Black woman, for the world, I have found, is not simply rich because from day to day our lives are touched with new possibilities, but because the past is studded with sisters who, in their time, shone like gold. They give us hope. They have proved the splendor of our past, which should free us to lay just claim to the fullness of the future. Proust was a neuroscientist, written by Jonah Lehrer. This same principle is even at work in our brain. Neuroscientist Fred Gage has found that retrotransposons, junk genes that randomly jump around the human genome, are present at unusually high numbers in neurons. In fact, these troublemaking scraps of DNA insert themselves into almost 80% of our brain cells, arbitrarily altering their genetic program. At first, Gage was befuddled by this data. The brain seemed intentionally destructive, bent on dismantling its own precise instructions. But then Gage had an epiphany. He realized that all these genetic interruptions created a population of perfectly unique minds, since each brain reacted to retrotransposons in its own way. In other words, K chaos creates individuality. Gage's new hypothesis is that all this mental anarchy is adaptive. It allows our genes to generate minds of almost infinite diversity. Like the discovery of neurogenesis and neuroplasticity, the discovery that biology thrives on disorder is paradigm shifting. The more science knows about life's intricacies, about how DNA actually builds proteins, and about how proteins actually build us, the less life resembles a Rolex. Chaos is everywhere.